Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas, big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Welcome to the Intercooler Podcast.
Welcome to episode 161 of the Intercooler Podcast with Dan Prosser and Andrew Frankel. Now, this week we are talking about the Porsche 911 in racing. It's a good time to do it, and I'll explain why in the main episode. This year, as we know, in September, that will be the 60th anniversary of the Porsche 911, which is why over a handful of episodes this year, we're marking the occasion by talking about the 911. A few weeks ago, in episode 154, we covered the early cars, the air-cooled road cars. A bit later on, in a few weeks, we'll do the water-cooled road cars. But this week, we're talking about the 911 in motorsport. Plenty to get our teeth into. Before we get started, please rate and review the podcast if you can. We really appreciate it. It makes a big difference. And while you're doing it, just hit the follow button or the subscribe button on whichever app you use. That really helps us. It actually helps us to find a bigger audience and do more with the podcast. So please do that and enjoy the episode. In some ways, we've painted ourselves into a corner here, Andrew, trying to tell the story of the 911 in motorsport in a single episode. It's just not going to happen, is it? Because it is, I haven't been able to back this up with any data this morning, but it is the world's most successful racing car, isn't it?
You don't need any data. Just ask yourself, what else? Possible car could rival it?
Yeah.
You know.
And the point is, so we know the 911 model line has been around for 60 years now.
Yeah.
And it's not just been competing in sprint racing, or it's not just been competing in endurance racing. The story of the 911 racing is really one of variety, isn't it? Long distance racing, sprint racing, rallying, rallycross, every corner of the planet for decades now.
It's done just everything.
There's so much to say.
And I guess the point to start with is that, you know, it's not as if this car was designed from the outset to be a racing car. This isn't some, you know, sort of racetrack refugee which they bolted some number plates onto. You know, as we know, the car made its debut at the Frankfurt Motor Show in 1963. Porsche didn't build the competition derivative of it. Well, they didn't get round to it until sort of 67, 68. So it had already been around for, you know, most of what people would consider to be a life cycle before Porsche even bothered to go racing with it. Now, others had gone both racing and rallying with it, but they were private cars. And yet, despite all that, it just went on to be, I mean, I've just been looking at, you know, a few areas of competition in which it got involved. And there are periods of dominance which are so simply astonishing that if you didn't have a 911 or a 911 derivative like a 934 or a 935, there seemed to be genuinely very little point even showing up.
It is amazing, isn't it? It is amazing.
Why do we think this is? Is it that configuration, that unique configuration with a flat six engine slung out behind the rear wheels, which is in scientific, physical terms appears to be so flawed? Is that some kind of magical solution? Or is it that Porsche just engineered it better than anybody else, or just made cars more available than anybody else? Were they just more into it than anybody else? Did they think harder, clever, better than anybody else? Is it a combination? I don't know. I don't really know why it is. I mean, there are clearly certain advantages you get with having your engine back there, and maybe we'll get into those later. But ultimately, I think it's as much, if I'm honest with you, down to the company and its approach to racing. And just the rigor and the intelligence with which they went about everything that they did, that to me is the key to success. And obviously what we also know, don't we, is that nothing succeeds like success. And once you have hit upon a formula that works and customers pile in, unless you give them a reason to go somewhere else, they're going to keep coming back. So that's, I think, right. I think the 911 is like the vessel. I think it is the means by which the exceptional standards with which Porsche approached, you know, all competitive forms of competition is expressed. I think it's just Porsche deciding to do something better than anybody else, and the 911 was the tool it happened to have knocking about at the time with which to do it. And I think that was was the same in the late 60s, and I think, frankly, it was the same right up to, you know, last year when the RSR 19 won its class at Le Mans, and has now been retired. Yeah,
you're quite right. It took Porsche a few years to get going with the 911 in motorsport, but once it did so, and actually once it had established itself in racing, Porsche has been utterly committed, unwavering in its commitment. Others think Mercedes-Benz. You know, so many other brands, they come and go. They dip in and out of racing as and when it suits them. Porsche, across different categories, different disciplines, has been there consistently, almost since day one, well before the 911.
Yeah, I mean, it's like Ferrari in Formula One. You know, they have always been there. Except I guess the difference is that Porsche have been there for 60 years with the same car. And use that car to do everything from, you know, there's not a major sports car race in the world that a 911 or a derivative thereof has not won.
And
yet it's also won the Monte Carlo Rally. I mean, it is, it's bizarre.
And the Dakar Rally. We'll come
and
on
the
to
Dakar
that.
Rally.
How diverse are these motorsport disciplines, and yet somehow the 911 has been able to win in all of them. It is amazing.
Yeah.
It is amazing. Now, we're recording this on the 12th of May. It's a Friday.
It is.
The 13th of May will be precisely 50 years to the day since the 911 Carrera RSR won the Targa Florio in 1973.
Ah, there you go. So by the time anybody listens to this, it will have happened.
Yeah. It will have happened. And to mark the occasion, on the Intercooler app and website, we've published a two-part story, which I'm deeply proud of. I think it's fantastic. I would say that. In the first part, Andrew writes about the Carrera RSR, its gestation, that Targa in 1973, and actually particularly the restoration of that particular car, R6 they call it, because in 2018 it was comprehensively restored by Max Didpage. And it's a great tale. So that story is on there. And we followed it up with part two, written. And this is, I think, maybe the coolest thing we've ever done, potentially. Mel Nichols was there in 1973 to watch the Carrera RSR win the Targa. He was there. So he's written a wonderful piece about his experience of being on that event. In that same article, it's a great piece, isn't it?
Well, it is. Sorry, just before you get on to the other half of the same article, you know, there will be people who listen to this who will remember Mel's wonderful writing in Car in the 1970s and the 1980s. You know, half a century on from that Targa Florio, just go and read what he wrote for us. On the and if you're worried that whatever your talent is, you might lose it, you know, because you know you're 50 years older than you once were. Well, you might, but Mel hasn't.
No,
and he writes. It's just the most beautifully evocative piece of writing, so superbly crafted. you know, so much atmosphere without ever becoming sort of florid or overblown. It really is a masterly piece of work. Sorry. And
it is. And then in the second part of the same article, Karun Chandok drives R6, the car, the very car that won the Targa Florio 50 years ago. He thrashes the thing around Goodwood and writes about his experience doing that. So I just think, how cool is that? We've got this story from a guy who was there on the day, followed up by one of our guys driving the very car. And this is why it's so great having a team of writers like we do. Not just because they're great writers, but because of the things they have done and the things that they
exactly.
get to do.
Yeah, exactly. And to have, you know, in the same story, you know, two writers who are so exceptionally well-suited to telling their sides of the story for such dramatically different reasons. You know, Karun, because he is, you know, he's a superb, you know, Formula One driver and a fantastic communicator. And Mel, because he was there half a century ago. And, you know, there's nothing like, you know, the trackside view, is there?
No, there isn't. There isn't. Yeah. So I'm really proud of that two-part story. And I hope if you go and read it now, you enjoy it. Okay, so let's get back to the 9/11 then.
Yeah.
Let's go all the way back to the early years. Now, I don't know if you'll take issue with this claim, but it looks as though in January 1965, and remember, this is within a year and a half of the 9/11 making its debut at Frankfurt, that was the first time a 9/11 entered a motorsport event.
Yeah, no, I wouldn't argue with that.
It was the Monte Carlo Rally.
Yeah.
With Herbert Linger and Peter Falk.
Yeah.
And they weren't really supposed to be competing in the event. Porsche just wanted its car in Monaco on the world stage.
Yes.
For the world to see.
But just so this doesn't sound inconsistent with what I said earlier, this wasn't a competition car that, you know, that Porsche had produced for that. It was a 911. And I mean, go on, because I have dug out a fact about that particular event, which to me speaks for everything, you know, about the 9/11. But go on.
Herbert Linger being Herbert Linger. And actually, I met the bloke years ago, wrote a story about him. He is a fascinating guy.
Yeah.
I think he was
one of the great unsung heroes of Porsche.
One of the first employees of Porsche. It was him. He's from Weissach. It was him who said, build your test track and your R&D facility here. It was him who, he was involved in the Steve McQueen film, wasn't he? He did some of the driving for that. And it was him who first drove a 911 in competition. And he was a great driver. And of course, he wasn't just going to pookle along and make sure the car got to Monaco without any damage. He wanted to show what the thing can do. And he came fifth on the Monte. Which is just fantastic.
Not only came fifth, he won his class. And this, and what I was going to say is the Monte that year was so grueling, it was so tough, that, he said, reaching frantically for his notes, there were 237 cars entered it, 22 finished it.
Less than 10%.
Less than 10%.
Yeah. And one of those was a 911.
Yeah.
Okay, so now that we're on the theme of rallying, I think we should just stick with this for a little bit, and we'll come to circuit racing a bit later on.
Yeah.
But that Monte in 1965, Herbert Linger, perhaps inspired a chap called Vic Elford. We know Vic Elford well, don't we? And he saw 911s being used privately, mostly in rallying, and he spotted some potential in the car. He thought, I reckon this thing could be competitive. At this time, Porsche had no plans to be involved in rallying. It did that Monte in 65 as a one-off just to show the car off, not really intending to be competitive in that event. There was no budget for rallying, no team. But Elford nevertheless persuaded Porsche to lend him a car for the 1966 Tour de Corse right at the end of the year. And he finished third. Now, Vic was, before the event, well aware of the 911's reputation. That's something we've discussed in the past, isn't it? And there's this lovely quote from him. I spent the 24 hours of the Rally of 10,000 Corners, that's what the Tour de Corse is known as, learning to drive a 911 and discovered that the monster was a myth that asked only to be understood, coaxed, and gently seduced into doing the right things. So he found that if you drove the car in the right way, it could be wonderful and it could be competitive. And he finished third. he says the logical next step was the Monte Carlo, only a couple of months later. Again, no real support from the factory, but they gave him a car. And he says, after 2 weeks of reconnaissance, recce, the 911 had no secrets for me. I was right. It was the car of the future. And no matter what the conditions, wet, dry, snow or ice, it was capable of doing everything better than any other car I had driven. We led virtually the whole way until going over the Col de Turini for the last time when the snow came out of nowhere and I was caught on the wrong tyres, dropping to third behind a Lancia Fulvia and a Mini. He did finish third. But it goes on. The Monte was an enormous global event back then. It really was a huge deal. And the 911 finished third, Vic Elford driving, and it was suddenly thrown into the spotlight. Now, this is a month later, February, and ITV, the British broadcaster, stages the first rallycross event at Liddon Hill in Kent. Rallycross, as we know, they use purpose-built racetracks, but they build the sort of fiddly gravel section so that you're using part of the racetrack and then a gravel section, so you've got split surfaces, and you're racing wheel-to-wheel, door-to-door. And Vic says, since the 911i had jumped into the headlines almost overnight, ITV insisted that I find one in which to do the event. He borrowed just a standard road car from the British importer.
Well, it was AFN's demonstrator.
Yeah,
it was just about the first 911 into the country. One of the first right-hand, and it was a completely bog standard car. I might have driven it.
Oh, really? Okay, well, hold that thought. It's a red car. GVB911D was the registration plate. Very famous car now. And apart from big knobbly tyres, it was just a standard road car. And there's a great pic of it at Liddon Hill, this first rallycross event. Rubbing door handles with a Cortina, Elford driving. And of course, he goes and wins the thing.
First ever rallycross event.
In a standard
road car.
And that Porsche clearly thrilled with all of this. Third on the Monte, won this thing called rallycross. And so they start creating a small rally department with Elford as its driver. They won the 1967 European Rally Championship in a 911 with three wins. A year later, well, the next year, at the start of 1968, the Monte Carlo Rally, Elford goes and wins it in a 911S 2-litre.
Sorry, I might have to pick you up on that.
Oh, go on.
I don't think it was an S.
Was it?
I think it was a T.
Like one?
The only reason I mention it is not to sound like a smart ass, but to provide a little insight into what I was talking about earlier about the way that Porsche go racing or competing.
Go on.
Because my understanding is they had the S, which was faster than everything else, but that was an irrelevance because you could tune these things up anyway. But what they wanted to do was to homologate their rally car around the very lightest 911 they had, which was the cut spec, poverty spec 911 team. And it was light, but just because they'd taken everything off it. And so the lightest car they had was the 911T. And so that's the car that they put forward to be their competition car. And by the time it actually went onto the Monte, it was, you know, it was so tuned up, it was massively faster than anything else they ever had. But I just love that thinking that, you know, you think, oh yeah, we use 911X because that's our faster one. They go, no, let's not do that. Let's use our slowest one because it's also our lightest one, and then recover the performance.
And that's
what it was.
That's great, isn't it?
Yeah.
There you go. And then Bjørn Valdegard won the Monte the next 2 years in a 911. Porsche owes Vic Elford a huge debt of gratitude for all the 911 achieved in rallying. Remember, the car's not even 6 or 7 years old at this point. And so everything that it achieved in the European Rally Championship on the Monte Carlo Rally will have done wonders for the 911's reputation for its standing as a sports car.
Yeah. But I mean, presumably, in the world of rallying and before the era of four-wheel drive, you know, if we ask ourselves why four-wheel drive transformed rallying in the 1980s, one word, isn't it? It's traction.
Yeah.
So it's not that surprising that a car which is got legendary tractive properties because its engine's in the wrong place comes along and does much the same thing in the late 1960s. It was just, although I'm sure that Porsche never even thought about it when they were designing it, it was just so brilliantly suited to loose surfaces.
Mm. Yeah, and it was therefore quick, but also a nimble, agile car, good power, still quite little. So yeah, no wonder it was quick,
also
particularly on
pretty indestructible.
Yeah, tough, really tough. Okay, we'll come on to circuit racing. I'll just quickly whip through the rest of the rallying stuff that I want to talk about. 1984, Porsche won the Dakar with the 953, which was a heavily modified 911 variant. It was designed specifically for the Dakar, but really as a precursor to the 959, wasn't it? It was kind of an experimental car about the Dakar.
First four-wheel drive Porsche.
Yeah, it had a four-wheel drive system. And Porsche had this program to try and win the Dakar, and the plan was to win it with the 959. But it entered in 1984 with this thing called the 953, and just went and won it.
Yeah.
Perhaps for some of the reasons we've discussed.
And it had four-wheel drive, but it wasn't like a sort of, you know, like almost like a sort of silhouette. It was a mildly modified 911. In fact, it had the engine in it. It was actually detuned from a standard because some of the fuel it was going to have to run on in Africa was so dodgy that they had to knock back the compression ratio and everything else to cope with it. So it's not as if they just went and created this bespoke rally car out of nowhere and just made it look like a 911. It was a 911.
Mm. Oh, that's fantastic. And then, of course, in 1986, the 959 did win the Monte. Yeah. The Dakar, excuse me. So it's just fantastic, isn't it? This thing was never, ever, ever supposed to be a rally car, but it has won some of the biggest rallying events in the world. It says a lot about the 911.
It does. It does.
Should we talk racing?
Yeah, I mean, it's so difficult to know where to start with it. I mean, we've discussed the 911R and the Marathon de la Route. The 911R being, I suppose, the first purpose-built competition 911 that the factory, you know, sort of created. Weighed 830 kilos. That's where, you know, ideas like the obsession for lightweighting, the detail where instead of having a badge on the front of the car, you just have a sticker. And if you look at the front of a GT3 RS today, it's got a sticker rather than a badge. And that is, you know, they may save a few grams that way, but really it's just a homage to the original 911R. And Vic Elford went with some other people and won this 84-hour race at the Nürburgring, which we've discussed before. It then went and set a series of speed records at Monza, including one for 96 hours. They just ran a 911R flat out for 96 hours around Monza, and it was completely fine. And, you know, that kind of, you know, set the tone. By this stage, the sort of GT categories at Le Mans were absolutely awash with 911s because people realised that if you want to, you know, have a car which is reasonably affordable, is just going to get round and look after you and everything else, then a 911 was just so much better than anything else, particularly because of the reliability. You know, you could have gone in almost any other kind of car, and it was always going to be a bit of a, you know, will it, won't it survive? 911s, unless you did something really stupid like crash them or over rev them or, you know, anything like that, They just go round and they just keep on going round until the flag fell. And that was, you know, another such an important facet of the extraordinary success of this car. Because if you're a customer and it's your own money, you're just not going to buy a car which, you know, might be quick enough to do quite well, you know, if fingers crossed it lasts. You know, the first thing you want, and, you know, and having, you know, race cars with, you know, a lot of quite sort of wealthy amateur drivers, you know, the first thing they want to do is to finish the race. Mm. You know, where you finish is secondary to that, particularly in long distance racing. And I've done a bit of that. You just want to be there at the end because, you know, would you rather come eighth and finish or, you know, be in second or third place when the car breaks with half the race still to go? Well, there's no contest. So I think that's a really, really important dimension to the 911 story. But I guess it really, really gets going, doesn't it, in the early 1970s. Now, if you remember, this is when Porsche had been, you know, winning everything at the top level with the 917. So much so that the rulemakers decided that that couldn't go on. A, nobody else was getting a look in, but B, those cars were getting so fast, they were genuine safety concerns even about that. So they basically, at the end of 1971, they outlawed the 917 by saying, by banning cars with of more than 3 litre capacity. Porsche only had the 908, which is an old car by that stage, dating back to 1967, I think, certainly 68. And they also, there was this feeling at the time that these prototypes were all fine, but they didn't look like anything that people could buy. And that they wanted to go racing, even if it was only for sort of class honours, with something which directly related to the product. And so that resulted in the 2.7 RS, the legendary 2.7 RS Carrera, which itself was the car that homologated the 2.8 RSR. Mm-hmm. And, you know, R6, that car we were talking about earlier, which won the Targa Florio, that was a 2.8 RSR. And in 1973, that road car, you know, in a championship, was still allowed 3 litre pure prototypes. It won Daytona, it won Sebring, it won the Targa Florio. I mean, it is, it's unbelievable, really. And then the RSR went on to dominate GT category racing for years and years and years. I mean, I don't know how many occasions it didn't win, but just, you know, if there were RSLs there, you weren't going to win it if you weren't in one. And then in 1974 came the RSR Turbo. Again, a 911, a road car 911, and it came second at Le Mans in 1974, beaten by, it split the factory Matra prototypes, which were basically, and I mean this most sincerely, Formula One cars with enclosed bodywork. That's what they were. Wow. They had the same engine they used in Formula One cars. They were so extreme, those cars. They were like fighter planes. And here comes this, this 911, this Porsche road car, and splits them. I think there's a story that actually, and I don't know if this is true, I like to think it's true, there's a story that the Matra, which was leading, one of its drivers stuck it in a sand trap, and Porsche helped them dig it out. And had they not done that, then the Porsche would have won the race outright. And the reason I'm told that this happened was because the Matra, that Porsche built the gearbox for it or something. So they had a vested interest in that. I'm not sure whether that's true or not, but I kind of hope it is. And then the RSR, you know, begat the 934, which begat the 935. The 935 is another... Okay, to give you an idea of... I'm sure you all know what I'm talking about when I say 935. It's basically, it's a 911 with that sort of droop snoot nose, that very aerodynamic nose. And it raced in Group 5. And it started out in 1976 with about 530 horsepower. And by the end of the decade, well, they created one called Moby Dick, which had 845 horsepower. and was, again, this 911-based car was the fastest car down the straight at Le Mans. It was recorded at 227 miles an hour. And frankly, the only reason it didn't win the race, it was so heavy on fuel and tyres and everything else. I think it had to stop something like 43 times during the course of those. Basically, it was stopping every half an hour. And that kind of held it back. But, and I did look this up because I had a... There was something in my mind, so there was some extraordinary 935 statistic. So I looked it up. So the 935 between 76 and 79 won 150 major motor races. In the DRM, which was the forerunner of the DTM, you know, the German Touring Car Championship, for three seasons, 1977, 1978, 1979, it won every single race.
Oh my God.
Every single race. In fact, there were a number of races in which every single entrant was either a 935, a 934, or an RSR.
Blimey. Now that is dominance, isn't it?
Dominance of a kind. I can't think of any other car over such a prolonged period. Because even if we think about, you know, the great Group C era of Porsches and 956s and 962s, you know, they were occasionally caught out. You know, a Lancia would come along and, you know, nip an odd race here and there. You know, the 917s, you know, on tighter circuits, you know, Alfa might win a race, you know, Ferrari won Sebring in 1970. But, you know, but those RSRs, they won literally everything. Sorry, yeah. On the 935s, the 934s. I don't know another racing car which achieved such dominance over such an extraordinary long period of time. And, of course, it also won Le Mans.
Yeah, I was going to say, but just once?
Yeah. Well, no, twice. Yeah. Well, twice, really. It depends. Well, it depends what you mean by a 911. So, well, so in 1979, the Whittington brothers, who I think both went to prison in the end for drug dealing, and I think sharing with Klaus Ludwig, they won in a 935. What everybody remembers is one of the people who were driving the 935 that came second. Who was Paul Newman, movie star Paul Newman, who did an incredible job. It was the first time, and I think it was actually ended up being the only time, because he hated the experience so much, because he just didn't want to be a movie star abroad, and you know everybody was in his face all the time. So he came over, he shared a 935 with Dick Barber and Ross Stommelen, who were both extremely accomplished racing drivers. He did every bit as much of his fair share of the races, the other two, unlike, for instance, Steve McQueen at Sebring in 1970, who did the absolute bare minimum and just took all the credit for coming second in that. So he was out there in a 935 with ridiculous power, unbelievably spiky car, unbelievably tricky car to drive, in the middle of the night, in the pouring rain, because it was a very wet one that year. And the only comment he had to make after it was, I don't think my driving was that good this year. That's literally the only thing. I don't think I did too good. I think that's what he said. And you know, Dick Barber was going, don't be ridiculous. He did incredible. And he did. It was an extraordinary drive by anybody. But for someone who was a complete amateur to come over to a circuit like that, which he'd never seen before, in an environment like that, where everybody wanted a piece of him, in a car like that, in conditions like that, in a race like that, I mean, I think that is one of the great Le Mans stories. So they came second. So a 935 won it in 79. And then, yeah, I guess the GT1 98 won it in 1998. But it was only really the front end of that car was a 911. I mean, it was a mid-engine car. It was basically a prototype. It was one of those prototypes which clings to a fig leaf of production car reality because someone at Porsche has been unbelievably cute with the rules.
Yeah.
And they called it a 911. And it, you know, it had a flat six engine, and the front end of it was genuinely, or by then it would be 996 base, wouldn't it? But yeah, I wouldn't think there'd be too many interchangeable components. So yes, it won Le Mans twice.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
So how many of these 911 or 911 derivative racing cars have you driven? Which ones stand out?
Well, I've been really... Yeah, I have been quite lucky. So the first one the earliest one I drove was a beautiful short wheelbase 1965 car, which I did a Le Mans Classic in 2010. I was a bit nervy about that, just because, you know, you even in your head, you know all these stories about how, you know, tricky these cars are to drive. You know that they're largely illusory. You're still, you know, as you head out down the Mulsanne Straight for the first time. a bit sort of, I wonder what this is going to be like. And actually, the car wasn't good. It was weaving around and it was aerodynamically unstable. Until, so I can't remember what, somebody who raced these things years, they said, yeah, put the spare wheel back in the nose. And so we did that, and then it was just good as gold. And that was fantastic. That was a really, really, that was a really lovely car. And then after that, well, I've driven a 911R. I've driven the original prototype 911R. I drove that at Brands Hatch years back, which was, it was amazing, but it wasn't the sort of drive where you can really just fling it about, because I think we had noise issues and the owner didn't want me to do too many laps and that sort of thing. So although I have driven it, I drove it quite hard. It's not one of the sort of most memorable experiences that I've had in one. I've also done things like, I've driven Moby Dick, but you know, up the hill at Goodwood. So how much can you really learn from an experience like that? I mean, it was an amazingly fun thing to do. And I remember the ridiculous amount of lag. I've driven Baby as well. Do you remember the 1.4 litre car they made to get it under the, underneath the 2 litre homologation thing? So that's the car with the most lag of any car I've ever driven. It was 1.4 litre car. I think it had 450 horsepower. And I remember leaving the line. This was only a few years ago, leaving the line at the bottom of the Goodwood Hill and genuinely thinking I'd broken the car, because it was just going... and just as I got to the point where I would have braked for the first corner, except I wasn't going fast enough to need to, suddenly all the boost arrived. And it was quite good fun after that. I think probably the most sort of, I hope it's interesting, so certainly to me, most instructive sort of comparison I can do was, I can provide, is that I drove... not quite one after the other, but in reasonably quick succession. I drove a cup car, so that, like, the, you know, the standard, if there is such a thing as a base race 911 offering, and the RSR 19, so the ultimate racing Porsche 911, in quite quick succession. And they were, despite the fact that they were both 911s, they were as different as different as different can be.
So before you tell us what they were like, let me just jump in, because so these are modern cars.
Yes.
You know, they, I think this was only a couple of years ago that you did this.
Yeah,
they
were so the cup car was a 991. It was a couple of years ago. It was the last of the 991 cars, so it's not the, so they now race 992 based cars, but yes, absolutely.
So the cup car is it's technically a GT3 car, or it's built to GT3 regs, but it's not. It's only built as a one-make racing car, isn't
Correct.
It? So they're not full GT3 spec at all.
No, at all. And the thing about them is that they have, they're totally analog cars. So they have very little downforce, although they've got a big wing on the back. They really don't have much downforce. But much more importantly, they have no traction control, no stability control, no ABS. You are completely on your own in there.
That is a... quite frightening prospect, actually. And then compared to the 911 RSR, which is the one that won at Le Mans last year.
Yes.
So they're not running this year. I think the GTE category is gone, isn't it? So until last year, this was Porsche's
highest level
factory
is
racing.
Is that Porsche is putting its efforts into its LMDH car. I don't know if they're going to be private RSRs there, but they won't be Porsche. They won't be a Porsche factory team in that category anymore.
No, and the 911 RSR is a very different car to the 911 Cup car. It's got much more aero. It's got more systems. I think it's probably got ABS, isn't it? And it's got traction control, switchable,
multi-stage. It's got absolutely everything. It's also got its engine within its wheelbase. It's a mid-engine car. That's how different it is.
That's what I wanted to discuss. I mean, does that make it feel, apart from all the other differences, does that make it feel like a totally different prospect to the Cup car?
Well, the car felt like a totally different prospect to the Cup car. How much of that was the engine? How much of that? I mean, I would be surprised if a Cup car and a RSR 19 had more than 10% component commonality. You know, one is a car which costs, I can't remember, I think a Cup car costs sort of like early six figures. An RSR 19 is £1 million motor car all day long.
Unbelievable, very different.
Yet despite that, I don't think an RSR, because of the regs and the restrictor, I don't think an RSR 19 has got any more power than a cup car. But to drive them...
But seconds quicker, presumably, around
dozens
conventional lap.
Of seconds quicker. Yeah. I mean, just, yes. Yeah. And Porsche described the RSR 9. I saw this in a in a bit of bump they gave us. They described it as a single-seater racing car designed to comply with the FIA sporting regulations for that category at Le Mans. That was their approach, was they created a single seat. And when I was showing around it, I asked them to point out parts which had come from the 911 road car. And I can't remember the name of the guy who was showing me, but he pointed to the badge on the front. And he said, this is the same as with the GT3 RS. And he pointed to the rear lights. And I said, well, the rear lights, he said, are the same. And he said, no, not the rear lights, the glass that covers the rear lights.
Oh, my God.
And he said, so far as he was aware, they were the only bits that they had in common.
Wow.
And to drive, I have to say, I massively prefer the cup car.
Mm.
The RSR19, it felt like a prototype. It felt like a purpose-built racing car. And so basically, if you're at my level of ability, which is, you know, competent, but hardly going to, you know, win any championships anytime soon, you sit back and you watch the show. And it is amazing. But whatever you can do it 1,000 times better. And you're not quite a spectator. But I tell you what, it's like being a director. You tell it what to do, but it's doing it, not you. You're not an actor. You're not on the stage. You're an operator. And it's unbelievably impressive. It could do things you wouldn't think that any car which looked like that could do. And the downforce is amazing. And it's just so unbelievably easy to drive. It's so, certainly the speed I was driving, which was as fast as I could make it go, it was so idiot-proof. I never had a moment in it. I just sat there thinking, wow, wow, wow. I just didn't think that cars, you know, derived from road cars, however distantly, could do this. And I got out full of admiration. And I haven't really thought that much about it since. Cup car, I think about all the time.
Mm.
It was just such fun. It was, you have to be on your toes because you are on your own out there, and you know it's slicks, and it hasn't got much downforce, but it's got some. But the tyres they have for those cars have to be very carefully managed, and I just love the fact that it's just you and the car, and there's nothing else. There aren't any safety systems going, don't worry, we'll step in when you run out of talent or whatever. And I just found it, and I found it so much more intuitive. And I suppose it's because my history is in racing old cars. When I looked at the times I did in the cup car, I was so much faster than I thought it was going to be. And I think it's because I just felt at home in there. I just felt that I understood it. And the fact that it had no safety system didn't scare me. In many ways, I quite liked being able to feel where the limits of the car were. And, yeah, I mean, it's just absolutely my kind of racing car. Just fantastically good fun, totally dependent on you as the driver to not mess it up, utterly analog, all about sort of feel and balance and always involving. You're always doing something. You're not just sitting there and steering. You're always correcting it. There's always stuff going on. It was brilliant.
Wow, that is interesting. I've not driven a cup car, but I understand that they can be tricky things, even spiky little buggers. And I can well imagine that with your background in historic racing, you're on top of that sort of thing and you're quite comfortable with it, as you say. But I know that on that occasion, one of our journalist colleagues, with less experience, but a competent driver, raced a fair amount, a mate of mine, he did crash one.
He crashed that car. He was the next person in it.
Yeah, and he did knock himself up, knock himself about a bit, didn't he? So there's no question that you have to treat those cup cars with respect, because they're not going to nanny you. And I think actually that's the point, isn't it? That's why they build them that way, because they want them to be challenging, and they want the guys who race those things and graduate into other categories to really learn a huge amount about racing.
Yeah, I think it's why a lot of people who do race cup cars successfully go on to do other stuff very successfully too. And I think it would be quite difficult to come to something like a cup car if let's say your background is in racing modern sort of single seaters, with huge amounts of aero and tricks and toys and that sort of thing, and you come into one of those, I think you might find it quite difficult and quite alien. Whereas, you know, for me, who grew up racing cars that if they weren't sliding, they weren't, you know, they weren't going fast. It's, you know, it was, I wouldn't say it was second nature to me at all, but I think I probably was lucky in that, you know, I wasn't, those, when the car started doing that, I wasn't sort of immediately going into sort of crisis management mode. I was kind of a bit more comfortable with it. So, yeah, maybe.
The Carrera Cup, that's what it's called, which the 911 Cup cars run in, has been running since 1990. And at the end of last year, it's 5,000th 911 Cup car, which is extraordinary for a racing car. 5,000.
And those are just Cup cars. Those aren't racing 911s. Those are just Cup cars, Squad Cup cars, and I think Super Cup cars as well. You know, Porsche is, you know, they make more racing cars than anybody else in the world, including companies that only make racing cars. It is.
It does say a lot. It says a huge amount about how Porsche has been committed to racing for decades. And the reality is, it reflects in the product, doesn't it? But not only the GT3 RSs and the GT4 RSs of this world, but in every sports and performance car Porsche builds, there is motorsport expertise and know-how running through it. And quite rightly, you know, the company has been committed to racing for so long, and it shows in the product. You just can't deny that. Where do you want to go from here? I mean, is there some aspect of 911 racing history that we haven't touched on?
It's quite difficult to get to sort of work out what the right level of detail is. I mean, you know, you could really, really deep dive it, but, you know, we've only got a few minutes left and, and we would time out. I just find the fact that this car has been around for so long. It's just utterly remarkable. And I hope that they keep on making race versions of... Now, I mean, you know, we know now, don't we, about the Mission R, which is the electric sort of Cayman-based thing with 1,200 horsepower. And I don't know whether that's going to be the kind of car which, you know, is going to take the place of, you know, 911 Cup car racing in 5 years' time. I suspect it probably will. And so I guess the question is, what's the future of racing for cars like 911s? I mean, I think at a club level, I think they'll go on forever. You know, I go and do the Spa 6 hours every year, and, you know, the car to have in that, you know, unless you've got an awful lot of money and you can afford a GT40, is a 911, for the same reason that people had 911s a little more in the mid-60s. You know, they'll get you around, they'll look after you, you'll have a huge amount of fun, and you'll come somewhere. So I think, you know, and I think if you look at what guys like, you know, Richard Tuthill are doing with their ICE experiences and the rally cars that they're creating, I mean, there's a whole other industry that now that, you know, so many 911s have become historic cars, which has sprung up to service that requirement. But the future is interesting, isn't it? I mean, I just don't know, as it is with all aspects of cars, you know, we just don't know what the future holds. But, you know, I just hope that there are still flat six powered, you know, Porsche 911s racing in it.
Well, and also being raced by the factory, because they have been for decades. And it would be a shame if that stopped. I mean, we spoke about the GTE class at Le Mans. It's been replaced by a new category, hasn't it? And I think with GT3 based cars. Now, actually, I don't know if Porsche is entering that with a factory program. If not, this...
No, it's not. I don't think
maybe,
it is.
Maybe... No, so maybe the 911 isn't going to be raced by the factory at a very high level any longer. That would be a pity.
It would be. I mean, I think so much depends on what happens with its LMDH program, which I don't think has been exactly, you know, covered itself in glory so far. You know, I think they're sort of like competitive. But, if that turns out to be successful and they end up selling lots of customer cars of those, because I think one of the point about the LMDH car category is that it's an affordable kind of prototype as opposed to the LMH. And if that turns out to be the next 956 or 962 and they end up making hundreds of them, as they did with the 962, then maybe they will feel that there's no great need to go GT racing at the top level. And let's not forget also that, you know, there's still the GT3R, which is their GT3 car. There's still cup cars, there's still super cup cars. I mean, there's a whole sort of ladder of 911 race cars. And it probably says more about me than the 911, that the one I enjoyed easily the most was the one on the bottom rung.
Yeah. interesting. Very interesting. Okay, well, there we go. I mean, we've got a listener question coming up in a moment, but that is briefly the history of the 911 in motorsport.
Yeah, and we've got one more 911 themed podcast to do, haven't we? Which is like the sort of, because we did the old road cars a few weeks ago, and now we've done motorsport. And so I think where did we get to? Did we get to the end of the air cooled era? I can't remember where.
Yeah, we did air cooled. That's right, we did air cooled. So we're going to do water cooled in a few weeks.
Yeah.
And that'll be the third episode as we're sort of celebrating the 60th year of the 911.
Yeah.
But that's to come a little bit later on. So before we do the listener question, I am just going to remind you all to rate and review the podcast. And a positive review, please. Thank you. We appreciate it. And please just hit whichever app you use, please just hit follow or subscribe. It's really important that you do that, and it helps a lot. So the listener question this week comes from Rob. And he wants to know what our ideal road car would be. I'm interpreting this as ideal sports car. Now, I'm actually not going to give away an answer to this.
Is that it?
Yes.
So there are no qualifications?
No.
And we're doing this in the middle of a 9/11 podcast.
We are a bit. But we're not going to give a definitive answer to this one. And I'll explain why. I think it's a great question. I think it's a fantastic question. Something for us to ponder. But I want TI to explore this very subject in more detail.
So what is the question? What is your definitive...
What is your ideal sports car for the road?
What is your ideal sports car for the road?
So while you ponder some of the basics, right, and we're not going to give away too much detail because that would be a shame, I just want to say this. At some point in the near future, I want the Intercooler to investigate this in more detail. And I want to lean on our team of contributors. Because think about it, we've got designers, we've got engineers, we've got a racing driver, we've got enormously skilled road testers, we've got people who understand the sports car market inside out. I think we can apply all of that knowledge and expertise and experience to this very question. But briefly, I've thought about this a lot, and I think my ideal sports car is going to be relatively compact. It's going to be as close to, say, 1,300 kilograms as possible, but it is going to have small rear seats. I've got a child now, so that's totally changed my view on small rear seats. An NA engine, 300 horsepower is plenty. Manual gearbox, supple suspension, understated styling. Modern tech inside, though, so good AC, a decent stereo, Apple CarPlay. And I think there, in all of that, you've got the bones of what would be just about my ideal road car.
You know, you have just described a Gen 2 rear drive manual 997 GTS coupe.
That's it, isn't it?
You have just described that car. I'm sitting here with a car in my head, sitting here quietly not saying anything, and then you just describe it for me.
Yeah. We're that predictable, aren't we? But it does come back to the 911.
Yes.
Like it or not.
Yeah, okay. I completely agree with you. We should do it, but I think we need one little rider on it, which is that it can't be a 911. Because my fear is that if you go to all those people, and because of the 911's versatility, because of the excellence of its design and its engineering, and because how much fun it is to drive... maybe for very different reasons, but my fear is that everybody's going to go, well, it's a 911. So I think we should
do it, right.
But we'll say...
It can't be a 911
claim. Okay, so the question is to all these people, if the 911 didn't exist, and then ask the question. That would then, I think, produce some very interesting answers.
So we'll do it, but we can't just clone the 911 because the 911 already exists. So, very interesting one. We're going to ponder this one. We'll kick it around between us. And at some point, we'll investigate it properly. But, Rob, thank you for asking the question. Hopefully, you will get your answer in time. But keep your questions coming across.
Please.
We'll do it again next week.
Ask lots. Thanks. Bye.
Thank you.
Imagine Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Bowl and Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Bowl and Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bowlandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.